I have to admit, I spent probably a good 20 minutes just staring at the photos in the show notes for this one.
Oh, the side-by-side ones.
Yeah, before I even read a single word of the text. On the left, you've got this slice of a meteorite, the Regina meteorite.
From 1808, yeah.
And on the right, a piece of modern steel.
Yeah.
You know, from a bridge or something. And they look identical.
They are incredibly striking.
It's this wild, geometric basket weave pattern. Looks like something alien.
Yeah.
But here's what gets me, and this is where I want to start our deep dive. The notes say they're chemically completely different.
That's right.
One is space rock, the other is man-made. So why on earth are we seeing the exact same pattern, the same fingerprint?
It is confusing. And you're not alone. When a researcher, Osman, first saw this pattern in a steel ingot back in 1900, he was completely baffled.
I bet.
For almost 100 years, that pattern, the Widmansteddon pattern, was thought to be exclusively from meteorites. So finding it in regular steel was, well, a bit of a scam.
Metallurgy scandal. I love that.
Yeah. Oh, it was huge. But to your question, yes, the chemistry is different. The meteorite is iron nickel, cooled over millions of years.
Right.
The steel is iron and carbon, cooled in a factory. But the physics, the way the crystals choose to arrange themselves to deal with that cooling, that's exactly the same.
So nature really only has one way of solving this particular problem.
It seems so, and that's our whole mission today. This structure, which we call Widmansteddon ferrite in steel, it's not just a pretty pattern, it's a masterclass in compromise.
Okay.
It's a structure that acts like a military unit, builds its own tents to handle stress, and acts like a complete diva if you mess with its environment.
Military unit and diva. Those are not words I usually associate with a lump of metal. Let's start with the military part. I'm seeing this term displacive transformation everywhere.
It is. It's very forceful.
What does that mean exactly?
Okay, so most of the time when steel transforms, the atoms are like a crowd leaving a concert. It's chaotic. They all just sort of diffuse randomly, bumping around, trying to find a new spot. We call that reconstructive.
The civilian method, total chaos.
Right. But Widmansteddon ferrite is different. It's displacive. Picture a deck of cards on a table.
Okay.
If you push the top half of the deck sideways, the cards slide over each other. They don't shuffle, they stay in order, but they shift their position.
A coordinated slide.
Precisely. The iron atoms move in perfect unison, like soldiers on parade. They keep their same neighbors, but the whole grid of atoms, the lattice, shears into a new shape.
Okay, but hang on. I'm looking at the temperature charts here, and this is all happening at pretty high temperatures, isn't it?
Relatively high, yes.
Well, isn't that a huge contradiction? If it's hot, the atoms should be vibrating like crazy. They should be in a mosh pit, not a disciplined march. You usually only get that kind of instant snap to attention military transformation when you quench steel really fast, like with martensite. So how does it maintain that discipline when it's still so hot?
You have just put your finger on the central paradox of this entire structure. And the answer is, well, it's one of the stranger concepts of material science. It's called periequilibrium.
Periequilibrium. That sounds like you just made that up.
It really does, doesn't it? But it's a real thing. Think of it like a hybrid state of being.
Okay.
The big, heavy atoms, the iron, manganese, what have you, they are locked into that military formation. They have to move in that coordinated, displacive way.
The heavy troops are in lockstep.
Got it. But the carbon is this tiny little interstitial atom, and at these temperatures, it can move incredibly fast. So while that big iron framework is sliding like a deck of cards,
Yeah.
the little carbon atoms are just zipping through the lattice, almost like they're a liquid. They're diffusing all over the place.
That is so weird. So the structure is acting like a solid for the iron, but like a liquid for the carbon at the same time.
Exactly. The growing edge of the crystal, the interface, is what we call glissol. It
Oh,
can
man.
glide, but, and this is the big catch, it can only glide as fast as the carbon can get out of its way.
Ah, okay. So the army is ready to advance, but it has to wait for the civilians to clear the streets first.
That's a perfect analogy. The iron atoms can't slide into their new positions if there are carbon atoms in the way. So you have this potentially super fast military mechanism that's being held back. It's being throttled by the speed limit of carbon diffusion. That explains why the plates are so sharp and geometric then. It's not a blob, it's a spear point. But let's go back to that deck of cards slide. If I do that, the whole deck leans over.
Yes, the shape changes.
So does that happen to the steel? I mean, it's the solid. If one crystal inside of it suddenly tries to lean over, wouldn't it just get crushed or crack the whole piece of metal?
And now you've found the next big problem, which is strain energy. And the shear value from the source data is It's staggering. It's about 0.36.
Okay, I have 0.36 written down here, but that number means nothing to me. Is that a lot?
It's massive. Let's put it this way. If you applied a shear strain of 0.36 to a skyscraper, the whole building would be leaning at an angle of about 20 degrees.
Whoa, okay, that's not a lean. That's a collapse.
Exactly. So for a single crystal trapped inside all these other solid crystals to try and distort that much, it's a mechanical disaster. It generates this enormous elastic strain in everything around it. The steel is basically screaming.
So why doesn't it just tear itself apart? How does Widmanstetten get away with this?
It cheats. Or maybe a better word is, it cooperates. This is where that alien pattern really comes from. If you look closely at the images, the plates almost never grow by themselves.
I see that. They're in pairs, like little V-shapes or tents.
That V is the entire solution. It's a mechanism called self-accommodation. Imagine one plate starts growing and it tries to shear everything to the left.
Huge strain.
Huge strain. But then right next to it, another plate nucleates and starts growing that shears everything to the right.
Ah, they cancel each other out.
Perfectly. It's like two people leaning back to back to hold each other up.
Yeah.
By growing in these tent formations, the big macroscopic strain is neutralized.
That is unbelievably clever. So the basket weave isn't just a pretty accident. It's a structural necessity.
It has to happen that way. If it didn't, the stress would be too high for the structure to even form. And because of this little trick, the stored energy, the penalty the steel pays for allowing this structure, is surprisingly low. It's only about 50 joules per mole.
50 joules per mole. I'm going to call that the rent price. To live in the steel, a Widmanstetten plate has to pay 50 joules of energy rent.
That's a really good way of thinking about it, and it's pretty cheap rent for all the trouble it's causing.
Okay, so it marches like an army, it waits for carbon, and it builds tents to save on rent. But you also called it a diva.
Mm.
What's so high maintenance about it?
It all comes back to that glissile interface, that smooth gliding motion.
Right.
Think of an ice skater on a perfect sheet of ice. They can just glide. That's our interface moving through the clean austenite.
Smooth sailing.
But what if you go and rough up that ice? What if you throw a bunch of gravel and debris all over the rink?
The skater's gonna trip. Can't glide anymore.
Exactly. In steelmaking, we deform the material all the time. We roll it, we forge it. This creates a mess of defects inside called dislocations. It's like throwing gravel all over the ice.
And for most other structures, I'm guessing that's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Defects usually give new crystals a place to start growing.
For the civilian transformations, yes. They love defects. It's a nucleation site. But Widmanstetten ferrite is a diva. It demands a pristine path. If you fill the austenite with dislocation debris, you block that gliding interface. The parade can't happen if the route is full of barricades.
So if I work the steel, if I deform it before the structure is supposed to form, it just refuses to show up.
It gets severely suppressed. The data shows that a strain of just 40% can almost completely stop it from forming. We call it mechanical stabilization.
That feels like a huge factor for manufacturing. You could be rolling a beam, you let it cool a bit too much, you roll it again. And you've just accidentally prevented this entire structure from ever existing.
You absolutely could. And that totally changes the final properties. You might be aiming for one thing, but because you worked it at the wrong temperature, you get something else entirely.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
It really shows how steel isn't just a substance. It's a physical record of its own history.
It has a memory.
Okay. Let's talk about birth. How do they start? We know they grow in tents, but how do they nucleate? The outline mentions a nucleation code and something about it being linear.
Right. And this is another clue that we're dealing with a weird hybrid transformation. Normally, in what we call classical nucleation, it's random. Atoms just happen to clump together, and if the clump gets big enough, it survives and grows.
A roll of the dice.
Exactly. It's pure probability. But for Widmanstetten plates, researchers found the activation energy had a linear relationship with the driving force.
You're going to have to unpack linear for me. Why is that strange?
Well, if it was random probability, the graph of energy versus temperature would be a curve. A straight line, a linear relationship, suggests it's not random at all. It means the seeds are already there, waiting.
The embryos are pre-existing.
That's the theory, that these plates don't form from random clumps. They grow from existing defects, specifically from dislocation arrays that are already in the steel. They're dormant. They just sit there until the temperature drops enough to give them the driving force they need to activate and grow.
So the blueprint for the alien pattern is already hidden in the steel's flaws before it even cools down.
That's the leading idea. And this leads us to the biggest plot twist in all the source material. We've been talking about Whitman's Denton Ferret like it's this unique thing, but it has a twin.
A twin?
Bainite.
Bainite. Okay, yeah, I know bainite. That's the stuff in high-strength steels.
Yeah.
But textbooks always treat them as completely separate things. Chapter 1 is Whitman-Stettin, Chapter 5 is bainite.
They're usually separate, but they are more than related. When you plot the nucleation data that start temperature, Whitman-Stettin, ferrite, and bainite fall on the exact same line.
Wait, what?
They share the same nucleation mechanism. They grow from the very same seeds.
Hold on. If they start from the same seed and they both use that same military displacive mechanism, why do they look different? Why do we even give them two different names?
It comes all the way back to your rent analogy.
The 50 joules.
The 50 joules. Remember, Whitman-Stettin ferrite is efficient. It builds those tents and pays a low rent of about 50 joules per mole.
The budget option.
Bainite, on the other hand, is much messier. It doesn't accommodate the strain as well. It's got a lot more internal defects. The rent for bainite is way higher. It's around 400 joules per mole.
Whoa, 8 times more. That's not budget anymore.
Not at all. So here's the decision the steel makes. As it cools, the driving force, you can think of that as the amount of cash in its wallet, it increases. At higher temperatures, the wallet is thin.
It's broke. It can't afford the luxury 400 joule bainite.
Precisely. So if it has enough energy to transform at all, it must pick the cheap option. Whitman-Stettin ferrite. It pays the 50 joules, builds the tents, and off it goes.
But as you keep cooling down,
the wallet gets fatter, the driving force increases, and eventually you hit a temperature where the steel can afford the 40,000 joules for bainite. And since bainite is a bit less fussy, it can often grow faster, so it just takes over.
So it's a purely economic choice.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm poor, I'll build the cheap, efficient tent. If I've got the energy budget, I'll build the messy, expensive complex.
That is it. And this explains so much about alloying. When you add something like nickel, you suppress the transformation temperature. You basically make it harder for the steel to build up its energy wallet until it gets much colder.
So you can actually cool right past the Whitman-Stettin window.
Exactly. You might cool so fast or suppress the temperature so much that by the time you have enough driving force to do anything, you're already cold enough to afford bainite. So you just skip Whitman-Stettin entirely.
And the source mentions an alloy C that can never form this alien structure at all.
Correct. For that alloy, the conditions are so suppressed that it cools all the way down and can only form martensite at the very end. It never gets the chance to even consider the budget option.
That completely reframes how I think about microstructures. They're not different species.
Right.
They're the same creature just reacting to its economic situation.
It's a very powerful, unifying idea. They're all on a continuous spectrum of displacive transformations, just governed by the energy balance.
Okay, one last technical bit before we wrap. The speed limit. We know the play tip glides fast but has to wait for carbon. The source talks about the sharpness of that tip.
Ah, yes, the Zener model.
And the logic seems to be a sharper needle means carbon have less distance to move out of the way, so sharper should mean faster.
That's the intuition, and that's what Zener's original model predicted. The sharper the tip, the faster the growth. Infinite sharpness, infinite speed.
But nature steps in.
Nature always steps in. It really doesn't like sharp things. See, creating a surface costs energy. We call it the capillarity or Gibbs-Thompson effect. And if you make a surface curve too tightly, if you make it too sharp, the surface tension starts to fight back.
It pushes inward on the tip.
Hard. It actually reduces the driving force for transformation. There's a point, a critical radius, we can call it Traer, where if the tip tries to get that sharp, the surface tension uses up all the available energy, and growth just stops.
So you've got two competing effects. Sharper is better for diffusion, but blunter is better for surface tension.
Exactly. And the steel, as always, finds the optimal compromise. The math shows that the maximum growth speed happens when the tip radius is exactly 2 times that critical radius, 2 blanks.
The Goldilocks zone. Not too sharp, not too blunt, just right.
Just right. It's sharp enough to shed carbon efficiently, but blunt enough that it doesn't get crushed by its own surface.
It's just amazing how much thinking a piece of metal does. It's balancing budgets, optimizing its own geometry, coordinating troop movements, building tents.
It is. We see materials as static objects,
yeah.
But they're dynamic systems always trying to find the lowest energy state. Whitman-Stettin ferrite is just a particularly beautiful solution to a really tough problem.
So next time I look at a steel bridge, I'm not going to see a simple geometric pattern. I'm going to see a compromise. a structure that exists only because it found the path of least resistance between, what, the vacuum of space and the inside of a furnace.
So maybe you'll question if we really need all these different names for things that are, at their very core, just trying to solve the same energy crisis.
The thriftiness of the universe. I love it. Well, that's a wrap on our deep dive into the alien structure in your steel. Thanks for sticking with us.
My pleasure.
We'll see you in the next one. Go explore your sources.